Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Jamila Battle. Welcome back, Jamila. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing pretty mighty fine, which is close to fantastic.
Then.
That's close enough, I think. And I think I'm really excited today because we're going to be talking today with an unusual guest, and I think fascinating for our listeners to hear, Ann Anderson, director and curator of the Country Doctor Museum, about her work preserving the daily lives of doctors past. I know that you have doctors past who are influential to you and your career, and this museum is dedicated to those types of memories.
Yeah, exactly. And I went into family medicine because of the inspiration of the country doctor.
Well, we're going to be inspired by Ann Anderson, but first we're going to talk about some research that matters. And let's dive right in. And this actually is one that is more about today than in the past, but I think it looks over time. And this is what private insurance pays for emergency department visits. And why do we even care about something like that?
We care about it because healthcare spending now makes up at least 17% of our total gross domestic product.
That means of every dollar you have, 17% of it theoretically goes to healthcare. That's like twice as much as every other country industrialized in the world. That's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy.
One of the reasons is because of how expensive the care is, and particularly things like emergency medicine care. And this is actually research done by some of our colleagues in family medicine and the Shep Center for Health Services Research at the University of North Carolina that was published in Health Affairs, looking at the cost of that emergency care over time. And what was the difference between if the person going to the emergency room had Medicare, Medicaid, or private insurance? What did they find?
So it sounds like in 2016, the average annual cost per person for healthcare in the United States was $10,345, more than twice per capita than other developed countries, as you noted. And what they found is between 1996 and 2015, annual increases in per-visit emergency department expenditures were significantly greater for private insurance than Medicare, Medicaid, and the uninsured.
Which means that insurance companies are paying more out if you're privately insured and you show up in the emergency room than Medicaid and Medicare and the uninsured, who probably aren't really paying as much, so they may not get billed as much. But what's interesting is then that means the private insurers are subsidizing the emergency room care. And I imagine if you're an administrator of the emergency room, you're pretty happy when that private insured patient comes in because you know you're getting paid more.
That's right. And it's possible that there's less bargaining power that the private insurers have.
And so they may not be able to get the same rates that Medicaid and Medicare
right.
get. On the other hand, I know that when you go to an emergency room, it's not unusual that you may get a bill for $5,000 or $10,000, depending on what's there. And we are trying to shift care from that emergency room really to less expensive modes of care. And that's why a lot of primary care offices like ours is open now, extended hours in the morning, in the evening, having urgent cares that you can go to rather than the emergency room. This is a piece of the puzzle would suggest that I think there's going to be more incentives, both private insurer and Medicaid and Medicare, to limit and put limits on emergency room care to cut the costs. Hopefully that's done in ways that aren't harmful to patients. The right care at the right place for the right price.
Yes.
Speaking of that, our next research that matters, and it's actually by one of our colleagues again in the Department of Family Medicine, Dr. Sylvia Becker-Dreps, who has, I think, a really important study in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine about the effectiveness of a common vaccination given to children, but also to pregnant women. What are we talking about?
This study reviewed more than 675,000 pregnancies in the United States from 2010 to 2014 and analyzed insurance claims data to identify the receipt of Tdap during pregnancy. And the researchers looked at hospitalizations and outpatient visits for pertussis in the infants through 18 months of age.
And this particular vaccine, this Tdap, is this vaccine that's designed in part to reduce cases of pertussis. And we know, particularly among newborn infants, they may be at higher risk if they get exposed of getting pertussis. And the vaccination they get certainly can be preventive, but for the pregnant women, if they get it later in pregnancy, those infants will have some of those antibodies mm-hmm. and they'll be less likely to get it. So they're trying to figure out, did this vaccination for those women who got it lead to reductions? Well, pertussis is rare, so they needed hundreds of thousands of cases.
They did. And they found that in the first 6 months of life for the infants whose mothers were immunized during pregnancy, there was a 75% reduction of pertussis hospitalizations and a 46% reduction of any pertussis cases.
So bottom line is, getting the pertussis vaccination, this booster among pregnant women during the third trimester, mm-hmm. at least 2 weeks before delivery, really is ideal. This is the first data out there that it really does make a difference that could be life or death. So we encourage it. Speaking of life or death, your patients probably have real thoughts about tanning.
They absolutely do. And in this study, it looks like health clubs use tanning beds to attract their members.
What? Wait a second. I belong to a health club. I don't have any tanning ones, but I belong to a community center. And the community center doesn't have tanning beds there. What are they talking about here?
Well, it looks like they explored gym tanning versus tanning in salons, and they called Planet Fitness, Anytime Fitness, and Gold's Gym in Massachusetts and Connecticut just to find out how many tanning beds were there. And of the 167 gyms that were found on Google, 66% offer tanning beds to their clients, with Planet Fitness being the biggest offender with a whopping 100%.
That was shocking to me. This is like some research that a professor in Connecticut and one of their students conducted, and they found out that these gyms have 408 tanning beds, and they made a calculation that if you extrapolated this to all 50 states, among these three gym chains alone, there'd be over 10,000 tanning beds. That's the equivalent of 1,600 mm-hmm. tanning salons. And they found out that people who, when they did a second survey of people who've ever used a tanning bed, they found that a quarter of the people who've used tanning beds use them in gyms. And they tend to use them more often than people who just use them outside of gyms. I guess it's easy to do it when you're in a gym. This is actually, I find, a significant and worrisome health problem.
Well, I agree with you, and I think they attribute this to gym tanners just really having a stronger desire to maybe look and feel better. But certainly, I think there's some inconsistent messaging there that kind of says maybe tanning's a part of a healthy lifestyle, but it certainly is not.
Right, and you can get tans with creams without having the tanning salon, which is cancer causing. And I think they make a good point. You don't, if people were saying, let's have smoking clubs at the gyms, you'd say, what? No, we're not going to do that. They probably wouldn't have bars at the gyms where you're sitting there getting drunk. Maybe some of them do. I hope not. We shouldn't be having the tanning beds. I think this is a no-brainer. You're going to have to press for it. Another no-brainer, last research that matters, is about cell phones and walking across intersections while you're looking at your phone. And I must say, I may be guilty of this in the past. I will not be guilty of this in the future. This is actually a problem.
This is a big problem. I almost stepped off of a curb texting and not paying attention and almost twisted my ankle. So it says here that pedestrians who are using their phones and crossing the street walk at a slower pace, and they're often walking in a more erratic fashion.
Yeah, this was research that was published in Transportation Research Record showing 38% of pedestrians were using their cell phones while crossing the street. I honk my horn when I see someone walking the street with a cell phone. And then, like, they get startled. I'm like, don't do that. I think that this is a no-brainer. You can wait till you get on the other side of the street, right? I mean, right. if you were walking across a bridge, you probably wouldn't be on your cell phone, one of those rickety bridges across the River Gorge, right? Okay. I'm not sure it's much safer crossing the street in most places.
Right. And they also say, I think this is interesting, that texting takes cognitive effort and limits visual sensory input. So, therefore, you're more startled, impaired to balance issues and falling.
You know, I love when people are texting and they also have the earbuds in, so they don't even hear me honking. It's like, you don't even hear me. Oh, my gosh. Okay, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Ann Anderson, director and curator of the Country Doctor Museum in North Carolina, about her work preserving the daily lives of doctors past. You're listening to Your Health. Stay with us. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamil Battle. Today on Conversation, Jamil, we're talking with Ann Anderson, director and curator of the Country Doctor Museum in North Carolina, about her work preserving the daily lives of doctors past.
Welcome, Ms. Anderson.
Thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
We're always interested in the subject matter of what we're talking about, and we're certainly interested in the museum and understanding its impact on the care past, present, and perhaps future of primary care, rural care, family medicine. But we're interested in you, too. How did you get interested in being the curator of a museum? What's the path, and how did you do it?
Oh, goodness, that takes me back. Really, it was just I kind of fell into it. I wanted to be an archaeologist. I loved Indiana Jones, and I thought what an exciting life that would be. And then I went on my first archaeological dig in college, and a snake came out of the pit I was digging. I was filthy. So my professor, who worked at the San Diego Museum of Man, pulled me aside and said, Annie, you need to come to my office and I'll get you an internship at the museum. And I just fell in love with it. Museums to me are like libraries, but instead of books, they have objects and you have to learn to read the object. But they all have stories to tell. And so finding out the information about the object, how it was used, who used it, I think that's important work in order to learn about what was done in the past so we can carry that information into the future.
And how then did you get involved in a Country Doctor Museum?
Oh, well, I went to graduate school. So my background is in museum administration, collections management. And my husband and I, when my children were little, we were living out west and in California, and we were looking ahead to their college years, and we realized we wanted to be in North Carolina for the UNC system. So we packed up and moved, no family, no friends, and we just fell in love with North Carolina. And I saw an ad for a museum manager, and it was at the Country Doctor Museum, and East Carolina University had just taken over the museum and was looking for someone to manage the museum. So I applied, and I was just very lucky.
That's great. Nice. That's great.
So tell us, what do the visitors experience when they come to the museum?
Well, I hope they have a good time. I think they're surprised when they come. I don't think they know quite what to expect when they come off the road into Bailey. It's a really small town. Perfect setting to talk about small town physicians of the past. I don't know if they're expecting like a roadside menagerie, but I hope they find a very professional but small museum with a lot of good stories to tell. So we are an old-fashioned museum. We give guided tours. And so we give tours on the hour. You'll have a tour guide that takes you through and talks to you, explains things, gives demonstrations on how to roll out pills. You'll see everything from a medicinal garden, an apothecary room, to our transportation collection that has a buggy, a Surrey, and some Model Ts. So I think they're surprised.
So let's pretend like I'm a visitor to the museum. How do we start? Where do we start?
Well, you just come to the gift shop and.
Okay, well, that's what my kids will be there. We'll leave them there and they'll get the. By the way, what type of gifts do people get, by the way?
Oh, we have all sorts of fun stuff. We have things for gardening, anything that relates to the museum. We have gifts for nurses and doctors. We have a lot of books, history books about the history of medicine, Civil War medicine, herbal. Treatments, and then just a lot of fun little gifts that you can buy for folks. But we try to have a little bit of everything. And so since we give tours at the top of the hour, usually if there's a little bit of a wait, we have a library room with displays in that and some videos that folks can watch while they're waiting. But usually we try to get people moving on a tour as quickly as we can.
That sounds actually amazing. I definitely would be interested in going. Can you tell us a story behind some of the artifacts that are there?
Oh, gosh, we have so many just amazing items. A lot of them were gifted over time beginning in the 1960s, and we still collect today. We have to be very careful because we're tight on space, but we still get calls from families with items that they don't know what to do with, and they're looking for a repository for them. But some of our favorite items, I think, we have an iron lung from the polio epidemics. So we talk a little bit about that.
And what for our listeners who may not be familiar, what's that?
An iron lung is kind of an artificial, non-invasive respirator, and it used to be used during the polio epidemics in the 30s, 40s, early 1950s, when polio patients had trouble breathing because of their paralysis, and so they weren't able to take a breath. So they would be placed in an iron lung, and it has a motor and a bellows on it, and it works on a system of positive and negative air pressure, which basically allows the air to come in and then pushes the air out, and it keeps the patient alive. And that's news to a lot of, especially our younger visitors who might not have even heard of polio, but a lot of our older guests, it's a touchstone for their memories, and so they'll share with us experiences they had growing up. They might have known someone who had polio or had a touch of it themselves, or were living in towns where an epidemic would be in the town, and so they wouldn't be able to go to the theater or a swimming pool. It'd all be closed down to keep the younger population, the kids, from congregating. We've had one guest say that they had to drive through a town where there was a polio epidemic that had gone through, and so their parents made them roll up all the windows in the car in the middle of the summer as they drove through town to try to keep them from developing polio. So there's a lot of things in the museum that will trigger a memory, and that's kind of special working there, as we get to talk to our guests who come from all over the world and are able to share with us memories about them either being sick or someone they knew having a health crisis, or their country doctor when they were growing up, something of that nature.
I imagine one of the things that I remember well, when I first started my training, was they were talking to me, my mentors, about doing home visits. House calls, and that this was a hallmark of being a family doctor. And I remember really quite well when I started it, and I still do house calls. What in the museum would represent that, what I would say is a fundamental commitment, and had to have been in many cases really one of the hallmarks of being a primary care, family, general practitioner?
Exactly. I mean, that's what country doctors were known for, is their house calls. And so we have actually a number of items I could point to, first being doctor's bags. They would have their, usually a black bag, but sometimes brown. We have all sorts of kinds that they preferred that they would take with them on a house call. Oftentimes they weren't very big because they didn't really have a lot to carry. A lot of our instruments and cases were all portable. They all roll up or fold up because they were made to be taken on a house call. We have medicine bags that would carry their powders or their liquids. And then as we go through time, we see where the doctors started purchasing their pills already made. And so we see all sorts of things, and we see one of my favorites is a little doctor's bag. You could tell with just use the handle broke off. So he repaired it with just a strap of metal that he bent around the hooks. And so it shows, I think, their ingenuity, their resourcefulness, their frugalness, things that were important to them, but just the necessary things they needed to take to see their patients.
Well, we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to actually continue this really fascinating conversation about Doctors Museum and the work that you're doing to preserve the past and help us understand the value of a personal care physician. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll continue our conversation with Ann Anderson, Director and Curator of the Country Doctor Museum in North Carolina. You're listening to Your Health. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Ann Anderson. A fascinating conversation. Ann is the director and curator of the Country Doctor Museum in North Carolina, talking about the work of preserving the daily lives of doctors and other health professionals. And, you know, right before the break, Ann, you were really telling us about a story about kind of the symbols of the profession. And one of the symbols of both doctors and nurses, I think, when people see on TV of times gone past, is the uniforms they wear. Did the uniforms, as far as you know, were they like they were today? And how did you see that represented in your artifacts?
Well, we have a small but wonderful collection of nursing uniforms that date back to the 1890s. And most of them date back to the early to mid 20th century when student nurses trained at local hospitals. They attended 3-year diploma programs. And so we have a number of uniforms that represent different hospitals. Each hospital had a different uniform. So they would have a student dress uniform. And when they graduated, it would become an all-white graduate nurse uniform. And of course, the cap, the nurse's cap, was kind of indicative of the nursing profession. So we have a number of different types of hats, and they were all worn with pride. We have a lot of journals that talk about how important it was to the nurse when they went to their capping ceremony and received their cap. A lot of nurses then and still today feel as if it was a calling to become a nurse and provide care to fellow people in their community. And so we have a lot of those types of items in the collection that some of our retired nurses that visit the museum as guests, they really connect to those uniforms and they talk about their nursing training experiences. And so we learn a lot from our guests.
What do you think a modern doctor would learn from the museum as far as like that past and what we can bring forward for today?
Oh, that's a great question. When I first started the museum, I had kind of a personal difficulty in connecting the relevance of the collection to modern medicine. But unfortunately, I had my own kind of health crisis a few years ago when I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I had a very healthy life, and then I was thrown into kind of the medical system where I was meeting different doctors and nurses and was unsure. And I realized that there was a dedication at the opening of the museum in 1968 where the speaker talked about the spirit of the country doctor. It was the country doctor's patience, empathy, ingenuity, all these character traits that kind of define a country doctor. And he called it the spirit of the country doctor. And I found in my experience that's still so important for patients going through a health crisis. I met some doctors that I was sure did not have the spirit of the country doctor, so I found a different doctor. And I think speaking with your doctor, knowing you have a connection, a trust, even though it might be a very short meeting, knowing that they're hearing you, that they understand your concerns, and there's an element of teaching that the doctor does to the patient, at least in my case, I found that to be very helpful, very rewarding in my relationship with my physicians. And so I think the museum tries to bring that out with our collection and talk about how many country doctors were leaders in their community in other ways, not just in the medical field, but in the community through government or church, and how they had a connection maybe over generations with the families that lived in their community. And that's something I think that is still important in today's healthcare.
You know, I wonder, and I must imagine, that pictures and stories are one of the hallmarks of remembering things in the past. And is there any picture or story or journal that you have there? What things just kind of strike you? If I were to come there, you would say, I want you to see this picture, hear about this story as written either maybe in a poem or a journal entry.
We have one of our rooms is set up as a turn-of-the-century sick room. So we talk about what it was like to have an extended illness from diphtheria or scarlet fever, things that we really don't have to worry about today.
Tuberculosis.
Mm-hmm. But one of our passages on one of our labels is from Dr. Shields, who practiced near Carthage in Moore County, North Carolina. And he talked about how he got a call that there was a family that was sick. And so he went out to the house. And it was just kind of a shack. The daughter had already passed away from the illness. The father was dying. And he built this kind of canopy of blankets over the father's bed because snow was blowing through the walls of the shack and he wanted to protect him. And Dr. Shields talked about sometimes we weren't really doing medicine. You were just trying to help as best you could. And sometimes it just took just being there with the family in their moment of stress. And so I think that was a really important quality that doctors knew. Sometimes there weren't words to express what the patients needed. They just needed to be there to walk into the room or walk into the house and give them some hope or to have someone else there on their side.
Nice. Powerful.
Yes, there's
That's
a lot of
powerful
things at the museum.
Yeah. And those are qualities that I felt led me into even the field of family medicine.
What about obstetrics? Because I imagine that you must have some artifacts that
yes.
deal with the country doctor who did obstetrics, which was the norm rather than the exception.
Right. We do have a lot of obstetric forceps and kits. We have a lot of larger doctor's bags, I think, where they're obstetric bags because they'd have to carry all those extra instruments with them. But we have journals and ledgers of country doctors who delivered thousands of patients in their practice over their careers. I had one guest when I first started at the museum, and he recognized the buggy in our transportation room. And I said, that was Dr. Irwin's buggy. Did you know Dr. Irwin? And he said, oh, my first name is Irwin. He delivered me at home.
And so, oh, my God.
And so we have all these stories. We had a group just a week ago who was the son of a country doctor. And he said he had a large family. There were six or seven kids in the family. And they would always leave one of the children at home on a Sunday morning when the rest of the family went to church. So if someone called or came to the house and needed the doctor for a house call or for a delivery, they would get in the car, drive to the church, and honk three times, and then the doctor would know to come out of the church and they would go on their way. So we do have a lot of stories about childbirth because that was done in the home. And so a lot of our guests were born at home still. And so it's nice to be able to talk to them about their experiences and knowing, you know, when the doctor came, that was something important.
This is the 50th anniversary.
Yes, we're celebrating our 50th anniversary. A group of volunteers started it in the 1960s. As they got older, they looked for new stewardship to carry on the museum, and they approached East Carolina University, the Brody School of Medicine. One of their priorities is to graduate family practice physicians who will stay and work in rural counties. And so our history of our museum kind of fit nicely under that that mission of the medical school. And so we're looking forward to our next 50 years, and I hope we can do good things.
And it sounds like there's also an oral history program and an educational program there as well?
We do. We visit classrooms. We have homeschool groups and classes that visit the museum, and we'll do hands-on activities. We just partnered with our local high school AP history class, and they did oral history program for a day where we invited members of the community come in and talk about what they remember their home remedies being, cobwebs for packing a wound, honey, and of course chicken soup, and just kind of odds and ends, things like that that you don't really think about today.
Yeah, I think in my case it would have been the matzo ball soup, but okay, you can throw some chicken in there as well. It'll work just fine.
Yes.
Well, we're so thrilled that you've been able to join us today and share that enthusiasm. You can hear it in the voice. I can feel part of me is in that museum right now, looking around and knowing that that work is one that must continue today. Everyone desires a primary physician, a family physician, an internist who really cares for them, mm-hmm. willing to step out and do the
yes.
right thing. And that sounds like your museum is really dedicated to that purpose.
We really try. Yeah.
It certainly would inspire a lot of the students as well.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I think it's an eye-opener to see just how little the country doctors had to work with. And they were kind of jack of all trades. Mm-hmm. And just to know this is kind of where a lot of our modern medicine came from, standing on the shoulders of these country doctors.
I bet when we go into that gift shop, we can find some stethoscopes.
You'll have to come and find out.
I'm going Christmas
we
shopping.
We might have a few to donate. We might have a few to donate as well. Well,
indeed.
We've been talking with Ann Anderson, director and curator of the Country Doctor Museum in North Carolina, about her work and the work of the museum preserving the daily lives of doctors past. We want to thank you for being our guest today. And we're going to take a short break, but then coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Jamila Battle. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Jamila and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. If any listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
My doctor just prescribed Singulair to help with a chronic runny nose related to allergies. I had been taking Zyrtec before that, and I've stopped taking the Zyrtec, but now some of my other milder allergy symptoms have returned, such as more easily irritated skin. Can I take both Singulair and an antihistamine at the same time?
Well, I do. Oh, this isn't about me, right?
Yes. What would you recommend to the patient?
Well, I think, you know, common sense is that allergies a lot of times need more than one treatment because there's multiple things going on, whether it's pollen or dust or exposure to foods or things that are causing it. So people's breakout. And so something that may work like an antihistamine that one takes, like the Claritin or the Zyrtec or the Allegras of the world, they like to be joined by their brethren who operate by a different mechanism, which is these leukotrienes, mm-hmm. and the Singulair is a different one and an oral pill that one can take. Mm-hmm. You probably have some experience with some other treatments.
Oh, absolutely. So both personally and evidence-based-wise, nasal steroids are excellent treatment options that hit a different mechanism of action. And I certainly have to triple up during allergies and take the Singulair, the Zyrtec, and the nasal steroid for some control. But certainly it is appropriate to take those in combination to, as you alluded, hit on different mechanisms of action.
We call that the Holy Trinity of allergy
yes.
care. But there's also, I think, the common sense things you'd want to do, which would be to limit the exposure, to really work on the dust pollen, to work on the air filters, to work on any of the things that could reduce the pollen counts. Make sure, you know, your windows aren't open during pollen season and just like brushing through the house, you know. So, so the short answer is keep doing what you're doing and maybe do more because you can get good relief here mm-hmm. and there's no reason you need to suffer.
That's right.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
My three-month-old cries on and off through the night, and we're worried that perhaps there's something going on. Not to mention that my wife and I are desperate to get better sleep. What are the best tips you can give to parents dealing with something like this, and how do we know when we should get her pediatrician further involved?
Well, there are probably more things written on infant colic, and I know that's not what the question was, but that's what this is raising. You know, does my infant have colic? Which leads us to understand, you know, what we're really talking about here is that the children who perhaps are crying for no apparent reason, meaning that their diaper's not wet, they're not sitting in stool, and it lasts for more than 3 hours a day and occurs on more than 3 days a week, and they're less than 3 months of age, that may well be colic. The good news is that it resolves 90% of the time by their within another month or two. But the bad news is it can sometimes really get in the way of a healthy child-parent relationship because the parent feels stressed and bad. They don't know what to do here. So a lot of times I find that we have to be in the position of supporting the parent and reassuring them of how to cope with this to really try to keep that relationship intact. I know that we used to recommend trying perhaps changing feedings. If there were formula, they may be breastfeeding, which would be better. Different ways of soothing the child, ranging from rubbing the stomach to, I've heard, putting in some white noise in the room. Things that have really no significant side effects.
Oh, those sound like wonderful remedies.
We would want to try those before we tried things that had some significant side effects. So there are some medications that have been used. Some people have used, again, switching from cow milk formula to soy milk. We don't necessarily recommend that anymore. And certainly don't necessarily recommend things like acupuncture, things like herbal tea. Some people would do. But again, there's no evidence they help.
And when should that parent be worried and take the child to the pediatrician?
Yeah, I think a pediatrician or the family doctor, if you're concerned, you know, a lot of times I hear parents come in, they're concerned about an ear infection, you know, and occasionally the child could have an ear infection, but most times it's not.
Right.
So I think it's okay to take the child in and get some reassurance. Sometimes the grandparents know what's going on here. So I think having a really good grandparent, maybe one that can take the child for a month.
Exactly, a month. Oh.
Laura, what's our very last house call?
I forgot my phone at home the other day and realized throughout the day as I kept reaching for it how often I'm on it. It made me curious. Can we be addicted to these devices and what should we do to sort of keep our exposure to them healthy?
Let me look that up on my phone.
Oh, my God. That's why I have the Apple
phone
Watch.
Here. Can you be addicted to the phone? Let me look it up. Like, oh, yes, it says you can be.
You certainly can. I think setting limits. Certainly shutting it off, and you don't have to have all of your emails or certain apps on. You can have those removed or turned off. So it keeps a boundary, I think, between just your work-life balance. I have an Apple Watch to kind of keep me – it kind of keeps me off my phone less.
Yeah, I think having downtime is really key. I left my phone at home by accident, and it turned out to be a great day. When I got home, there were about 15 texts from different family members wanting to know why I wasn't responding to them. But, you know, there weren't emergencies, and everything went just fine, and I was much less stressed. I wasn't getting phone calls and texts in patient rooms, for instance, which is really a bad thing to have happen. You know, your phone's going off, and you're in a patient room. So I'm a big fan of it. Much more so at night than the day, but in the daytime too, putting that phone down.
That's right. And it's interesting how I saw advertisement about staying connected, you know, and it was another smart device. And I laughed at it because I thought, gosh, these smart devices actually, I feel and believe, make us disconnected. Putting the phone down, I think, helps with connectivity just with people.
Well, we're in agreement on that. So we're going to all commit to not walking across intersections and reading, as well as putting phones down. That'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all of you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to your health. You can share any question and by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can follow us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter or Facebook or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank my great guest co-host, Dr. Jamil Battle, and our guest today. Ann Anderson. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Jamila Battle.
And we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.